From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oakland.
I'm from East Oakland.
I live on Belvedere Street, two blocks up from Haight.
I'm from the Sunset.
The foggy inner Sunset.
I live in the Mish.
Coming up, forget someone to love. How about someone to plant veggies with?
You know, the idea for this community garden and with all of our community gardens is that, you know, people can grow whatever they would like as long as it's legal. I always kind of, you know, add that.
Then we turn our eyes from the dirt to the sky for a celestial update from the urban astronomer.
The universe is like a television show. You don't know how it began. You certainly aren't going to get to see the ending. And you're trying to figure out the plot.
And we hear the story behind an all-girl teen rock band from San Francisco.
We met in kindergarten and started a band in fifth grade with eight guitarists.
We're seeing stars today on Cross Currents. San Franciscans love to garden, but backyards are hard to come by if you live in an apartment. That explains why the city's 36 community gardens have waiting lists with hundreds of names on them. So the city had to get creative with its newest community garden in Golden Gate Park, which opened in November. It brought strangers together to share plots of land in a garden matchmaking scheme that has already borne fruit. Or at least veggies.
Our team got together and sort of strategized on how can we bring folks together. And our concept was actually one of speed dating.
That's Melinda Stockman from the Rec and Park Department describing this unique experiment. KLW's Liz Pfeffer has been tracking one group to find out how it's growing. Here's a story.
I know what you're thinking.
Okay, come into the circle if you have a sister who's gardening, and like we'd all like come in, high five, okay, go back out, okay.
This story could be ripped from an episode of Parks and Rec, but it's really more like a dating show where the winners get to share 63 cubic feet of soil. It's time to meet four of them. A married couple and two perfect strangers who all wanted to grow their own food in San Francisco.
I'm Melanie Monghanong. I've been in San Francisco for about a year and a half.
My name is Stephen Fields. I live in the Inner Sunset, and I am a marketing copywriter.
I'm Margaret Castro, born and raised in San Francisco.
I'm John Castro. I've lived in San Francisco since 1982, I believe it is.
The group connected through a Garden Buddy meetup in August, based on their answers to a series of questions like this one.
If you were one of these vegetables, which one would you be?
I would be a carrot. The carrot, it's taking its time, and it's going at its own pace.
So far, they say sharing works. And instead of true love, the harvest is their prize.
Because you have to have sort of, you know, sort of common interests in what you're growing. You know, you have to have sort of like compatible, I guess, lifestyles and just like sort of getting a feel for each other's chemistry.
Stephen Fields is discovering his hunger for radish greens.
It's a little bit almost acidic. It's like eating the color green. It's very, very fresh. You get a little bit of that radish pepperiness in the, just in the greens themselves. But it's a lot more mellow, especially compared to the arugula. Delicious, though.
Speaking of arugula, that's what Melanie Monghanong can't get enough of.
I love all vegetables, and but if I had to pick, I think it would be the arugula. I love sort of that bitter, sort of wake-me-up kind of taste of arugula, and I think that it's so, it can be easily dressed with just some lemon juice and olive oil, and it's detoxifying, which is always good.
It's early spring, and the northwest corner of Golden Gate Park is in bloom. Once an industrial recycling center, there are now 67 raised garden beds situated between busy Frederick Street and a dramatic living wall of edible plants. Margaret and John Castro are delighted at their crop of vegetables peeking through their plot of soil.
Now it's nice and green.
So we have broccoli.
And we have cauliflower, bok choy, Brussels sprouts, and and then our radishes.
Parsley.
And that skinny stuff going along there is finally the carrots are coming up.
Melinda Stockman oversees all the city's community gardens. The garden buddy speed dating was her brainchild, but the idea that strangers could work together came directly from the community. I caught up with her on the garden's opening day.
Certainly unique, both in the amount of people accommodated and in the way that we've actually split up the plots.
Half of the people on the waiting list responded yes to a survey that asked whether they would be willing to partner up with someone they didn't know. As a result, half of the plots went to households, and the other half became part of the sharing experiment.
It's going to be up to those each individual team, whether they want to just put twine down the middle and straight subdivide, or do they want to communally manage and all decide on their planting plan really and harvest exciting. Together.
Let's go to our plot. We're going to do some digging. Let me show you how you can help me.
Sharing isn't for everyone. Gardener Jessica Moritis has her own plot and likes it that way. She says the community garden is the closest thing to a backyard her 2.5-year-old son has ever known.
This, we got really lucky. We've got our own plot. So it's just us. And then, we get to choose whatever we want and then take care of it, which is nice. I feel kind of bad for the ones that are sharing because I feel like they've probably got to, like, negotiate what goes in the ground. But we're pretty lucky, I think.
The soil itself is really wonderful. So I'm just going to take a bit of this. And then take it over to the plot. So I'm just going to spread some in here. Just a thin covering.
It turns out that some gardeners, like Stephen Fields, have developed an appetite for planting together.
I love the fact that it's a shared effort, and it's a wonderful way to get to know people, and it's really fun. As I mentioned, like, John and Margaret planted this lettuce, I think, during the course of the week. So it's almost like Christmas morning when I come here on the weekends and find, like, oh, there's something new here, new little gift. So it's pretty wonderful.
Gardeners like Fields and his group aren't just working the earth. They're sowing the seeds for future garden sharing projects. Isn't gardening a lot like relationships? Sometimes you put in a lot of effort and a plant doesn't grow. But if you're lucky, it blooms right. In San Francisco, I'm Liz Pfeffer for CrossCurrents.
Find out how you can start your own plot in one of the San Francisco community gardens at KALW.org. Click on CrossCurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. If you're outside right now, whether you're standing by a garden or on a city street, take a moment to look up. There's a lot more to that sky than all that blue and the few clouds this afternoon. And that's why every once in a while we take a little time to talk with Paul Salazar, or as he calls himself on his blog, the Urban Astronomer. The Urban Astronomer recently joined KLW's Ben Trefney in studio to talk about what's up with the universe.
The most recent new thing was validation for what's called inflation. So inflation represents an infinitesimal moment in time, as Andre Linde, the big scientist who's been credited with much of the discovery, would like to say. It's a millionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang began. In that window of time, there was this expansion of the universe that happened at a rate much greater than our current physics would allow us to say is possible. In that instant of time, right at the beginning, there had to have been expansion of the universe that happened faster than these physical laws would allow, that is, faster than the speed of light.
I don't understand exactly what they discovered here.
If there was inflation, there should have been these telltale signs. And now, many, many years later, they found the signs. So that's great. That's now a validation of a theory that this fellow Andre Linde put out 20 or 30 years ago and said there could have been this thing called inflation. If it did happen, we would be able to detect these gravity waves. And now, in the South Pole, buried deep in the ice with little sensors, they pieced them together and were able to sense with a high degree of certainty that, in fact, these waves do exist.
So what does this mean to you? the fact that they found this proof of inflation.
What that does is it ties together the Big Bang process more elegantly. What's happening is this. You know, if you could switch off the lights on the Earth for a couple of years and forget all the knowledge we ever had, and you start at the top of the Grand Canyon with a flashlight, and you and a few other explorers began to walk down a trail down the side of the Grand Canyon, and every day you shone your flashlight on the side, analyzing layers of rock, you would take a long time to realize that what you're looking at, in fact, is you're looking at layers of earth that have been carved away by millions of years of water flowing through. That's what's happening here. You could have posited a theory on the start of your trip down the side of the Grand Canyon that maybe earth was once made up of layers. This was an ocean floor, and now we've carved it away with a river. But it would take you a long time with a flashlight to realize that. But what if, as you began to make your way down the journey, someone came along with the spotlight, and then someone else came along with a really bright light, and then one day the sun came up and you saw it all? That's what's happening here with the Big Bang.
Well, that's Paul Salazar. He runs the blog The Urban Astronomer out of San Francisco. So let's go from cosmology to Cosmos, the new show with Neil deGrasse Tyson that really had a big marketing push. And I'm wondering, I've seen some episodes, and my son, who's 11, he's seen some episodes and really enjoys it. I'm wondering what you think as an amateur astronomer yourself.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is great, and I love what they're trying to do, and I love the cosmic calendar. This compressing all of time into 12 months and, you know, the spaceship of the imagination traveling through all these spaces. It's well done. That's fine. Neil deGrasse Tyson brings a different angle and a different perspective. He's kind of not the originator of these eloquent poetic passages that Carl Sagan put together. But he's a great educator. I met him once. He's a cool guy. I think that he's got a noble purpose that he's following. And again, I'm hats off to anyone and everyone who's participating in the process of bringing out and illuminating these kinds of scientific subjects for the masses. It's all good.
And Tyson has that charisma that can help carry the message.
Correct. He's just all over the place all at once. He finds himself in the TV programs and morning talk shows and on specials. And it's just great to have someone who's got the breadth and the readiness to challenge and fast wit and sharp and funny, but also very engaging. I think Carl Sagan had a whole different set of attributes that made him engaging for different reasons.
He was a little geekier, wasn't he? Neil deGrasse Tyson, he's sort of like, you know.
He's trying to be more
suave. He's a little bit of,
yeah. Yeah, he's definitely, you know, dresses better and doesn't, you know, you look back at Carl Sagan, he looks rather 70s stereotypical geeky science guy.
Uh-huh. But it worked.
He delivered on the message, yeah. And at the end of the day, that's what he was about. He was about, again, transforming. I guess at some level, maybe he was the original sort of guy who could look at that subject and make it beautiful and exciting, in addition to being true to the pure science behind it.
That's Paul Salazar. He is the urban astronomer in San Francisco. So before you go, we always like to talk about what we can see now in the night sky and what's coming up. So what are you looking forward to?
There's an exciting tetrad of eclipses coming up. That's four lunar eclipses in a row here in April, and then in October, and then April of next year, and October of next year, we're going to have a sequence of four total lunar eclipses that also, rather conveniently for us here in California, will all be visible from the North American continent. So in a good way, we're going to have a nice series of these lunar. People would probably go after a while, I've seen three already. Why do I want to watch the fourth, right? There's going to be so many of these. We're going to kind of get used to it.
There's going to be eclipse fatigue.
Well, there could be that setting in. But, you know, the first one's coming up, and the first one's always exciting, and that's going to be on April 14th, and it will be visible from California, of course. It'll be starting at about 10 o'clock at night, and it reaches its peak about 11:45 p.m. So it's a kind of a late night event, so stay up late if you can. Enjoy that. Take the kids out if they're able to stay up that long. And you're going to see the moon taking about 90 minutes to transition itself from being a full, bright, typical full moon. And then it gradually slips behind the Earth's shadow out in space, 240,000 miles away. And as it does, it takes on, it doesn't go out fully. It doesn't go dark and black, but it gets very, very dim. And typically it's glowing an orange or reddish color, which is a very beautiful thing. Because from the moon's perspective, when the Earth is blocking the sunlight is still being refracted around the edge of the Earth And what you're seeing is that accumulated light of all of the sunrises and sunsets happening on Earth simultaneously, then flowing across space and landing on the moon's surface. So what you're getting is a beautiful nonstop coloration of this of the moon from that aggregation of sunrise and sunset colors. It's a really quite a unique thing.
So what I'm wondering then, Paul, what would the Earth look like from the moon at that same moment?
So if you're looking back at the Earth, what'll happen is you'll have what used to be the sun, now covered by the Earth. And so you have a dark mass of Earth and then this rim of beautiful bright color all around the fringe, all around the periphery. That orange and red color would be coming from a 360-degree circle around the Earth. It's a rather unusual concept to think about. It's quite nice to, very vivid to think about that.
Yeah, so would that look like the Earth was on fire?
In a way, yeah, in a way. Yeah, it would be this glowing, curious object. Because again, if you live on the moon, let's hypothesize about that fun concept, and you spend your nights looking at the Earth from the moon's perspective is always in the same place in the sky. It's just a quirk of how the moon rotates once around its axis, it goes around the Earth once.
Uh-huh.
And what you do is you watch it over 29 and a half days go from new Earth, if you will, to first quarter Earth, to full Earth, to last quarter Earth, to new Earth again. So you're just constantly watching this beautiful changing, but really gradually changing thing over the course of 29 and a half days. And then what will happen on April 14th is you're going to have that special moment when it reaches that new phase, when normally it would be quite invisible. It'll have that glowing ring around the edge. It'd be quite fascinating.
Well, we could go there with a spaceship of our imagination.
That's the one. Take that with Neil deGrasse Tyson. That's right. We'll journey with him over to stare at the Earth from the moon.
That was urban astronomer Paul Salazar speaking with KALW's Ben Trefney. The San Francisco Amateur Astronomers Lunar Eclipse Viewing Party is coming up this Monday. They'll be looking at the moon from the Earth. Learn more and find a link to the Urban Astronomers blog at our website, kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. And now we go from the stars in the sky to ones you might see on stage. The Shees are an all-girl rock band that's been making music and playing concerts for years, even though they're barely out of high school. Shees is an acronym of the members' first names, Sammy Perez, Hannah Valente, Eva Treadway, and Sinclair Riley. They cite the Donnas, 60s girl groups, Hawaii, and the Beach Boys as inspirations for their harmony-heavy California sound. In this archive edition of Bay Area Beats, Alyssa Kapnick brings us the Shees story of being an all-female rock band making it big while keeping up with calculus.
We met in kindergarten. We became best friends and started a band in fifth grade with eight guitarists. It was fun, but it didn't work out so well. So in seventh grade, we formed the Shees with just the four of us.
Yeah, having a bunch of fifth graders in one room was a lot of drama per band practice. So I remember there was a pillow once that we were all fighting over that had, like, the Lucky Charms guy on it. Do you remember that, Sinclair?
Yeah, that was my brother's.
And a lot of fifth grade drama.
Yeah, I think people ended up crying over that pillow.
That happened
There was a lot of tears in fifth grade. We don't really cry at band practice anymore.
No.
Not usually.
Hey, boy, get out of my dreams. You're intruding on my world.
The Shees, or S-H-E-S, are actually our first initials. Sammy, Hannah, Evan, Sinclair.
We, with our friends at school and people we meet, we become like a collective, like, oh, it's the Shees. Like, all of us are like
we're a unit.
One unit person.
Thank you.
we thought that being tough was like the in way, I think, to the music world. And then we started getting older and more confident in ourselves. And then we realized that we could play music that we actually liked a little bit more, felt more true to ourselves. And that's when we sort of got our California sound by listening to the Beach Boys and more 60s girl group harmony, heavy music.
Hard to explain, it's the same, and it never will change. 'Cause I sit and you sit, and we'll never come to it.
This song is called Then It Starts to Feel Like Summer, which is the title track off of our album. It's about wanting it to be summer on one level, very simplistically, but also just longing for a certain feeling, almost like a nostalgia.
The only time age comes into play, I think, is when people don't take us seriously. Not just because of our age, but also because we're all women. But I think it happened more when we were younger. Just because I feel like the way to get people to take you seriously is if you really take yourself seriously. And we just didn't even know what that meant when we started.
Yeah, I think demanding respect goes a really long way, and we're still sort of trying to learn how to do that fully. But, demanding what you deserve in all aspects of being a band is really important.
Yes. This next song is called Picture of Houses. We wrote it about San Francisco, a city we love dearly.
We grew up practically in the venues. I remember going to my first shows at, Bottom of the Hill and the Fillmore, and it's really cool now playing those venues and being on the other side of things. It's just a really fun way to grow up.
Picture of houses is my life. Gray skies and warm sand, it's all right. It's all right. It's all right.
Don't be afraid to put yourself out there and make connections. I know a lot of the things that we've gotten as a band, a lot of the shows and deals, are through contacting other bands and venues. Even though we're just high schoolers, everyone thinks that's crazy, but we just did it and it's really worked out for us. So I think a big step is just getting in your mind that you can do it.
And you can hear new music from the Shees this Saturday afternoon at Amoeba Music on Haight Street in San Francisco. The performance is free and starts at 2 o'clock. Details are at klw.org. Click on Cross Currents. Today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes David Boyer, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Jasmine Lopez, Liz Pfeffer, Stephen Short, and Mary Willis. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Our line producer was Audrey Dilling. Managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported public radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.